loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The annual G20 summit, it is the first of the meetings of the world's 20 largest economies to be held in China. We will be joined for the full hour from London by Steve Keen, author and economist, as well as professor of economics at Kingston University. And from Moscow by international security and affairs analyst Mark Sloboda. Welcome, Steve and Mark.
Nice to be here.
Brian, always good to be on Loud and Clear. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much. Steve Keen, let's talk about the economics of this meeting. Of course, it's in China. China has been a locomotive of global growth in the last decade and even before that. But of course, the world is reeling from so much income inequality, disparities, and anti-globalization sentiment has arisen. China's trying to avoid being blamed for that. Talk about the G20 summit's significance and how does China view it?
Well, China sees it as yet another chance to get back to the level on the international stage it believes it deserves, which is where it was in the early 19th century before all the colonial invasions weakened it so much. That's always going to be its perspective. But in terms of where it sits in the global economy, this is not the first major G20 meeting after the financial crisis settled in, but it's one coming up close to the 10th anniversary of the crisis actually beginning. And I think what's sinking into people, certainly in economic terms, the slow, very slow rate of growth, which is persistent, which hasn't turned around after the crisis as most mainstream economists thought it would do. And the politicians themselves are now reeling from election after election being won by or seriously challenged by candidates who stand outside the Washington consensus, which really defined how most of the G20 leaders have seen their role for the last 15 years.
Mark Sloboda, the Wall Street Journal headline about the G20 is this: China will try to deflect G20 complaints at Hangzhou summit. Amid backlash against globalization, Beijing casts itself as a victim, not the cause of trade protectionism. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, I agree with Steve that China views this G20 as a coming out, as it were, and very significantly a push for what they feel as a bigger place at the global decision-making table. Particularly, they're looking for structural reform of global institutions that would allow them to have a bigger say, which I think, you know, from any objective measure, considering how important China is to the global economy now, that's entirely warranted. The question is whether the West will be willing to make room at the table. They haven't been so willing so far. China will also be using this as a platform to push for their own institutions and their own international programs, which they are perfectly willing to put forward as replacements or alternatives is a better word, to Western-led global institutions if that room is not made for them at the table. And we're talking about the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. We're talking about the New Development Bank. We're talking about China's One Road, One Belt initiative expected to link up with the Eurasian Economic Union. And all of this will be pushed forward infrastructure-wise, along with China trying to buttress and showcase a new global soft power that they are hoping to develop. As for accusations on both sides of protectionism, of course, there's no country that has benefited more from global trade than China. And in recent years, China has moved more towards a bilateral economic relations rather than multilateral. But, you know, at the G20, they'll be trying to present the benefits of both the West and China, and particularly we're talking about Australia and the United Kingdom, have made accusations about China against protectionism. China has done the exact same thing back at these countries. I expect that this will be talked about in the papers and so on, but actually they will try to – the G20 is largely a talking shop. I have very little, I think, of substance that will change the dynamics of the world is going to take place here, but tone and atmosphere matter, and China will push for multilateral global trade very hard on that.
Steve Keen, This is the first time the country that's a member of the G77, the developing world, has chaired the G20, has been the host of the major economies in the world. China, of course, is both a developing country and a huge part of the world economy. I want to go back, though, to the Wall Street Journal article. I want to read from it to you and have you comment. China is the most closed of the G20 countries in terms of inward direct investment, and at the same time, it is emerging as the largest investor in the world, said David Dollar, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution think tank. The lack of reciprocity presents a real problem for the world. And then the article goes on, failing to tamp down these contentions at the G20 will mean a setback in China's aspirations to reshape the global order, blunting triumphs such as the establishment of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, China's answer to the World Bank, whose membership is growing. Canada, last week, of course, became the first North American country to apply to join that bank. Talk about the tone of the Wall Street Journal article, and is its main thesis correct?
Well, I don't think it is, because if you look at what China was intended to do with the whole industrialization process, it's followed right from 1981, 82, when it started opening up at the Deng Xiaoping. The whole idea was to build a capitalist class in China, and that meant Chinese ownership of the resources that were being constructed. So, for example, I visited the Shenzhen Free Trade Zone, as it happens, while it was still being, literally, the concrete was being laid for it. And we were taken through the plans of the Free Trade Zone, and one of those was to, of course, exploit cheap labor, which every free trade zone in Southeast Asia has done. But the second part of it was to require that every firm that came in, mainly American firms, exploiting a loophole in American trade regulations to reduce tariffs. Every firm that came in had to have a Chinese partner. And within, five or 7 years, the Chinese partner had to own, whatever their initial capital was, had to own 50% of the business. Now, that's about establishing a Chinese capitalist class and getting China to have the ownership of the technology, which, of course, they've done brilliantly. They're not about to lose that. So the Wall Street Journal can bleat all it likes about a lack of reciprocity. The Chinese are going to smile and continue having that lack of reciprocity. That's the entire intention of their industrialization program.
Mark Sloboda, Canada, as I had mentioned, just joined the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank. Japan is now the only U.S. ally not to join the bank. How big of a deal is that to the United States?
Well, I think it is a definite sign that there is a shift towards a more multipolar world order. I think we're definitely seeing that. And the Asian Investment Infrastructure Bank, while definitely Chinese-led, I think is a better representation of that. The U.S. lobbied very hard and was very disappointed when European Union member states applied to join the Asian Investment Infrastructure Bank. And this move by Canada will also no doubt be seen as a defection of the ranks, as it were. Another big question is the U.S.'s, Obama's, shall we say, legacy globalization trade deals, both of which, the TTIP and the TPP, both of these are frayed and under stress, and both may fail to achieve any real results. And the TPP, I think, definitely be seen as an anti-Chinese economic bloc, which the U.S. was hoping to install. And when Obama was promoting the TPP, he very specifically said in these words that the U.S. should establish the rules of global trade, not China. And notice the language there. It's very hegemonic. You don't hear saying we should sit down with China and hash out the rules of global trade that would benefit everyone. No, it was very specific. The U.S. should make the rules. And I think that's failing. And, you know, the defection to the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and I think what we'll see here at China shows that there is a shift in the global balance of power that is becoming more and more evident, and the U.S. not always the top of the roost anymore.
Steve Keen, there were meetings at the G20 between Xi Jinping and President Obama that happened prior to the meeting. There was also a sideline meeting between President Obama and Vladimir Putin. Of course, the G20 gives an opportunity for world leaders to talk to each other. What do you think the main political message of those kind of meetings is? What's the U.S. agenda with Putin, say, under these circumstances?
Oh, that's one, right? So you're taking me out of my comfort zone there. But I think the clear area of conflict with Russia is, of course, over the expansion of the American attempt to expand into the Ukraine and the Russian play backwards. I don't know what's going to be said behind closed doors between those leaders. But, of course, Obama has to come out saying he was, you know, saber-rattling about the Russian transgressing on NATO rights and areas. And Putin coming back and saying to the national people back in Russia that he's maintaining Russian integrity. So there'll be a lot of posturing. I really would like to know what goes on when they shut the doors and nobody else is listening.
Mark Sloboda, same question to you.
Yeah, I think this is exactly my comfort zone now that we're out of the economics. And I think in many ways, as most of these global talking shop meetings are, it really is much more about politics than about economics. Economics is more of a tone and aspiration thing. Well, politics, the politicking really gets done at these meetings. And China has made a big deal, you know, both within government officials and in the state-run media, of saying outright that Vladimir Putin is the guest of honor of this G20 meetings. And that's very significant considering the cool reception that Putin got in Australia for the last G20 meetings. And both countries have been very keen to push forward this Sino-Russian condominium, this growing alliance between the two countries. And I think it has developed far more than a strategic partnership based out of realpolitik, which is probably how it started. But the U.S.'s, shall we say, aggressive foreign policies, a very militaristic Asian pivot towards China, quite obviously military containment, economic containment with the TPP, and likewise gestures into Russia's backyard, towards Ukraine, towards Georgia, the tensions in Syria, which are very important as the U.S. Tries to overthrow the Syrian government there with a host of aligned powers. All of this is pushing Russia and China ever closer together. So I think we actually have Obama to thank for that over the last 8 years. But some of the priorities on China's plate politically for this, it will try to avoid any discussion of the South China Sea, in particular the ruling that came down from The Hague for the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea that Manila, that the Philippines, initiated. And considering the response from Southeast Asian countries and prior things, they're perfectly willing to shuffle that under the table, as it were. It will be the West that may perhaps try to bring this issue up at there. China is very concerned about the THAAD, U.S. Anti-Ballistic Missile Defense System, that the U.S. says they're going to install in South Korea. And this has caused a major chill in relations between Beijing and South Korea, and also between Russia and the United States and Russia and South Korea, because Russia has the exact same concerns that this ballistic missile defense system can and most definitely be used against them and will be developed further and threatens both of their strategic deterrents. So that's really big on their table as well.
Steve Keen, we have about 2 minutes before we go to a break, and we're going to come back both to the economic and geopolitical and military issues being raised at the G20. But I want to ask you about how the Chinese media was presenting the decision by Canada to join the AIIB, the investment bank that's anchored by China. The Chinese media presented that as an indication that the United States was softening or changing its tone, its previously hostile tone towards the bank. Is it that, or is it that Canada's being a little bit independent from the United States?
Well, Canada's always been independent from the United States. It has the proud record of not joining America in most of its stupid wars, which just my ex-country, Australia, naively went along with each of the ridiculous invasions and attempts to overthrow governments in other parts of the world. The Canadians have never done that. So they've shown a capacity to be independent of America, and that's just another display of that, something they should be proud of, the capacity not to be cowed by their large southern neighbor.
And let me ask you again, since we're back in your comfort zone, Steve Keen, about economics. Talk about, and we're going to have to be interrupted, and then we'll come back and pick it up again. You were talking about China's strategy for opening up, the economic reforms that began at the end of the 1970s under Deng Xiaoping, of course, those morphed into different kinds and different stages and phases of economic development. But I want you to start to talk about what China's perspective was, because it was quite different for a socialist country, for a country led by a communist party up until that time, to create actually a capitalist class, an indigenous capitalist class created during and under a socialist government. And then that class then became a link for foreign direct investment. I'm going to come back to you and talk about that when we do come back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking with Mark Sloboda in Moscow and Steve Keen in London about the G20 summit. Steve Keen, talk about China's economic strategy over the past three decades. I mean, China had enormous economic growth after the Chinese Revolution, but it had the monopoly on foreign trade. It had central economic planning. The whole economic model shifted, and it was unusual. Perhaps it became the model for other socialist governments, but talk about how that strategy has been employed.
Well, it failed for actually reasons that are best explained by the brilliant and neglected Hungarian economist Janos Kornay. And he made this wonderful argument saying that capitalist countries are effectively demand constrained. In other words, despite in the opposite to what conventional economic theory argues, there's always an excess of capacity to supply and a lack of demand. Because any firm hopes to have more than its current share of the market, and because you're in a growing economy, when it builds a factory, the factory is always built to have excess capacity. Otherwise, you need to build a new factory the day after you finish building the last one. So there's always overcapacity in a capitalist economy, and because lots of different organizations are trying to capture that demand, say, in the automotive industry, you have innovation being the driving force to try to drag customers away from your rivals. Whereas a socialist country, you know, one manufacturer of cars, et cetera, tries to get as much efficiency as it can out of its resources. All resources are fully utilized, and you don't get enough investment to expand what each of the different areas need. So the easiest way to cope with that is to produce last year's models in larger quantities again. And then what you get coming out of that are shortages. And the shortages mean you don't reach your production targets, et cetera, et cetera. So it's an innate problem in a socialist economy. And China was a classic manifestation of that, overlaid by other factors I saw in a couple of visits there, where there were two factions in the Communist Party. One was a pro-grain faction, the other was pro-legume. We're talking a very agricultural country, of course. And you would then get the reaction of the local level to guarantee you didn't get executed when the policy failed. You'd say you simply carried out exactly what you were ordered to do, and you would flip-flop from one extreme to the other all the way through. The country was going nowhere. And the major change with the death of Mao, and therefore opening up the political space above the top of the Communist Party, gave Deng Xiaoping a chance to come back and say, we simply want to have a system that enables us to develop and industrialize. And that was the attitude, very, very pragmatic. But knowing at the same time to do that, they have to have a capitalist class. And that strategy was incredibly successful. First of all, they exploited the huge wage differentials and the complete absence of environmental controls, of course, as well, on production to establish gigantic productive capability, exporting into the rest of the world with a tremendous price advantage. And originally that was with American corporations exporting back to America and to the rest of the world. It ultimately became Chinese corporations doing the same thing. But of course, that strategy only works while you're building up when you're catching up in the catching up phase. They're pretty close to, they're not at the peak of the catching up phase yet now, but they're getting pretty close. And therefore, their growth rate has to slow down. They can't maintain that same rate of growth. And they also responded to the financial crisis by starting a credit bubble, their first major credit bubble. So they're now suffering, in effect, the pains of success, the pains of tapering towards the same productivity levels, approaching the same productivity levels as the West, and a credit crunch, which they've never had to deal with before.
Steve Keen, there was great economic growth during the Soviet period, during the 1930s, for instance, the period of industrialization, when there was a monopoly on foreign trade, there was central planning, there was public ownership of the means of production there, but it was all generally developed on an internal basis, based on the internal resources of Russia or the Soviet republics. This is far different. You have foreign direct investment now from all of the major Western corporations and even emerging country corporations into China. talk about its impact on the social and economic status of people in China and the kind of new contradictions that the Chinese government is coping with.
Oh, that's quite dramatic. I mean, if you visit China, as I've done on several occasions in recent years, the whole idea that the Chinese are a nation that saves us just becomes a joke when you look at the consumption habits in China. It's really been dramatically altered. Having seen it in 91, 82, and then seeing it again in 2013, 14, 15, it's a dramatic social transformation. But at the same time, there's people's awareness that the Communist Party is sitting on top of the entire structure, and it's a benevolent but dangerous grandfather in that sense. So you have at one hand, you have a very consumerist culture, a very modern, in anything goes type attitude at the social level, tempered by the knowledge that if things go wrong or if the Chinese Party, Communist Party, decides to crack down, it will crack down, and there is no reply to that. So it's a very strange, but at the moment, it's a very successful ambivalence. What I worry about is what happens when there's a large-scale economic slowdown, and that then means people who are living in cities but don't actually have the legal right to be there with the regional laws that apply inside China, and then therefore can't access social services. What happens if that starts to break down and they're forced to try to return to the countryside again? That's always going to be the danger, which is why China always tries to go back to the fastest rate of economic growth it can manage by whatever means it might do that.
Mark, we've been talking about China's economic strategy. We've been talking about the contradiction, both the successes of that strategy, but also some of the contradictions that China has encountered as a consequence. And it would be impossible not to, when you have a developing economy that becomes so dynamic, not only impacting, of course, the people who live inside of China, the 1.2 or 1.3 billion people, but impacting the entire global economy in a way that would have been completely, and I would say, unanticipatable 3 decades ago or 4 decades ago, certainly before the 1978 opening up period. But right now, China does constitute, in the last 10 years, I'd say, or perhaps last 8 years, according to the United Nations, 1/3 of all global growth. 1/3. I mean, that's an immense share of global growth. But now you have the European economy sort of in the doldrums. You have the United States economy, stock market's way up, but economically speaking, for the economy, for the people who live in the United States, also in the doldrums. And if China is starting to reach capacity or into overcapacity and it experiences a slowdown, which it is, it could have a profound impact on the world economy, a big impact on Chinese economy and the Chinese politics. Talk about it, if you would. Pick up on the same theme.
Yeah, sure. Along with this increased share of global growth, right, which is, of course, a very good thing for the Chinese economy, there also comes an equally or perhaps even greater share of, shall we say, responsibility or expectations from the rest of the world. The rest of the world is looking to China, not the United States, not the EU, but to China to lead the world out of economic recession, and an economic recession that was caused by economic bubbles in the United States, that then had an impact on in Europe as well. And this, of course, is problematic because China has become more focused on internal consumption in recent years, increasing consumption and the production for their own consumers. But in a way, it is specifically the Chinese consumers who are expected to lead the world out of recession. And that's a tremendous burden to place on the Chinese people, particularly when, there is a very strong national tendency in China, as well as in Russia, towards saving rather than debt spending.
Okay, Steve, we're going to just go right back to you and pick it up.
I think we have to put this in a global context that we've actually been through the biggest credit bubble pretty much in human history. And China was lucky to be not just industrializing at the beginning of that credit bubble, but also rode that industrialization, which was dramatically increasing its own productivity, selling into this enormous credit bubble. But the credit bubble has exploded in 2008. We're now in the aftermath to that. And we have, in most of the Western world, an excess level of private debt such that credit demand has virtually evaporated. And we now have China having to adjust to a world that won't be able to absorb the level of exports that China has based its growth on for the last 20 years. So it's now being forced trying to maintain the credit bubble going itself by its own expansion of credit. That's already now reached its limit, so it's got yet another problem coming out of that. They're talking about readjusting towards domestic demand, and that it really is the basis of successful growth, frankly. It's not international trade, not specialization. It's expanding your industrial capability and pushing up incomes to consume that at the same time. But they're going to be stymied again by the fact that they've equally had their own domestic credit bubble, which hasn't made Chinese households anywhere near as indebted as American households got, but it has made the Chinese corporate sector very seriously indebted and possibly unable to afford investing. So my feeling is what's going to happen is that China will initially go through a very large slowdown, which they're trying to disguise right now, and then respond to it by, again, government stimuli, which they can do because being such a mixed socialist capitalist country, they can flip from domestic private credit to domestic state money at the drop of a hat. And I think they will do that. But they're forever going to have to balance this tension that they have to be able to absorb the number of workers who are trying to move from the countryside where the pay was still very and conditions are still very poor to the cities, particularly the coastal cities, where the pay is much, much higher, but the social conditions for them are very fragile because they are not allowed to access social security or health care. So I see this as a very dangerous time for China. I think it'll navigate it well, but it's not going to be smooth sailing. And that's certainly in the context of a global economy, which is now in the doldrums and will stay there until we find some way to reduce the huge burden of private debt that's been accumulated in the last 20 years.
Mark Slobota, there was, of course, the puncturing of that credit bubble in 2007, 2008, that very bubble that drove economic growth that allowed also China to grow because the world economy expanded as a consequence of cheap credit. And then the world economy could absorb the great number of commodities and industrial products produced in China that allowed China to grow. China then, in turn, became an engine for global growth. And during the last 7 or 8 years, while the world was in recession, and even though China's economy slowed, it still had significant economic growth and kept the world economy afloat, more or less. If China experiences a major contraction, it, of course, will have a huge impact on China. But, of course, that also becomes a place where investment that could have been profitable in the past is no longer available. We could be on the precipice of a major global crisis that would make 2007, 2008, in the words of Mao Zedong, look like a tea party, precisely because there's very little other or few other avenues open to produce stimulation in the face of contraction.
Absolutely. In fact, I would say that it's not only a possibility, but it's becoming more and more closer. Inevitable as time goes on. It's a question of when, and it may be some time, but I think it is definitely something that is going to arise because the problem is not merely tactical, shall we say. It is structural. Okay, it is built to the system at this point. It comes on this over-reliance on China. And part of the reason for the over-reliance is because of the accumulation in China of capital that it is able to spend to spur the global economy. The West has huge problems with this because all of the countries of the West, from the United States across Europe, Japan, are so deeply mired in national debt, state and local debt, corporate debt, that they simply can't provide the spending on such, you know, Keynesian terms as infrastructure and so on that helps spur growth. They rely on China to do this. And China has become kind of the engine of global infrastructure development, and that's been a big part. If bubble burst in China, then I think we're looking at a long, very agonizing global depression that will probably, perhaps finally, make us take a look at, you know, the wider global economic infrastructure that seriously needs some fine-tuning.
If I can come in there.
Steve Keen, go ahead.
What we had in tech in 2008 was the bursting of a private debt bubble that was focused largely in America, England, and Europe. And China then reacted to that by setting its own private debt bubble, going from a private debt level of about 100% of GDP to over 200%. And a number of other countries did the same sort of thing, including Australia and Canada. And a total of about 16 countries that managed to avoid the crisis in effect by borrowing their way into the future. They're all running out of steam right now. China being one of them. So I don't think we're going to see a crunch on the scale of 2008, but we have another 16 countries which collectively are slightly larger in terms of global GDP than America was back in 2008, that are also going to run into a credit crunch in the next 2 to 3 years, maybe even sooner. And so we're going to go from China and these other countries being partly engines of growth to the rest of the world to that disappearing completely. And with that happening, we're going to see, if we're lucky, global growth dropping down to the order of 1 or 2% rather than the 3 to 5 that people have been factoring in for the last 20 years. And that level of growth is going to mean effectively a failure of the agenda that led us to this position, which was the whole idea of neoliberal government and the Washington Consensus and the belief that we should expand the private sector and restrict the government sector. That's all now falling apart. And I wonder just how much that's going to be on the minds of the politicians at the G20 meeting.
Okay, and that's the voice of Steve Keen. He is he's an author and an economist, as well as professor of economics at Kingston University. We're talking to him from London. And we're talking with Mark Sloboda, international security and affairs analyst from Moscow. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about the G20 summit. We're talking with Steve Keen. He's the author and economist, as well as professor of economics at Kingston University, and from Moscow by international security and affairs analyst Mark Sloboda. Steve Keen, we spent the first two segments talking mainly about China, its role with the world economy, its strategy, how China's evolution has impacted not only the people in China, the people in Asia, but the people around the world. But let's talk about the main drivers of the world economy who are not in Asia, meaning specifically the United States and the EU countries. Those countries, since the transformation of the economic recession into some kind of stability, not a great economic situation, they haven't been able to really emerge. They are not the drivers of economic growth. What about the prospects for them?
Oh, I think the most important one is Europe, because Europe has scored the classic own goal of the euro, which back in 1992, the brilliant non-orthodox economist Wynne Godley described as effectively a suicide pact for the countries of Europe when a crisis came along. And that's been duly proven true. And with the euro being there and the whole political structure of the European Union trying to preserve a failed currency rather than admitting it had failed and moving on, Europe is going to be stuck in a permanent doldrum and probably also serious political breakdown as well. I strongly expect probably a right-wing populist leader to come to power in one of the major southern European countries, particularly Italy or France, and break out of the euro. So Europe is going to be, as it often is, distracted by its own problems and caused by its own insane political decisions, and growing, if at all, barely growing, and the southern part of the continent probably shrinking. America, on the other hand, has got through the financial crisis, but it's done in such a way that it's only slightly reduced the level of leverage that the private sector had when the crisis hit. So it's gone from a private debt level of 1.7 times GDP to about 1.5 times GDP. And at that level of debt, any boost to growth that comes from credit rising once more is going to run out pretty rapidly. In effect, they've turned into another version of Japan without Japan's trade surplus. So I think in that sense, the two major drivers of the G20 are going to be pretty much becalmed. And in that situation, losing influence and politically turning in on themselves rather than being able to project their power externally. That's something which China, even though it might be complained about the loss of export markets, China's not going to be unhappy about that.
Mark Sloboda, in 2007, 2008, when the economic crisis hit so dynamically, Wall Street was in the throes of its biggest crisis since the Great Depression of 1929 to throughout the 1930s. The U.S. government intervened. It drew a circle around some of the biggest banks and said, these banks are too big to fail. It opened the spigots. It allowed huge amounts of government funding to go to the banks. They got a cash bailout of $660 billion with loan guarantees. That number was probably more like $7 trillion. It was money, no strings attached. Now, the stock market has tripled in its value and prices during the last 8 years, even though, and perhaps that's where that money's gone. But again, the United States does not appear to be in a situation where if it was hit by another economic crisis, that the central bank, the Federal Reserve, or the government would be able to do the same sort of stimulus package. again, stimulating not necessarily the economy and not rescuing the people, but stimulating the fare or the fate of the biggest bank so that the entire economy did not tank. It has limited options right now.
Yeah, this sense of the states to increasingly print its way out of its own self-manufactured economic crisis. I think that in the future is becoming increasingly limited. And while we had the bursting of the real estate bubble that was in mortgages, that was the primary cause of the 2008 economic crisis, we do have other very significant bubbles in the U.S. economy, and one of the biggest of those is college debt, you know, with the extremely expensive U.S. education system, which is actually becoming self-destructive as the costs of it are all of an education, higher education in the United States are becoming greater than the benefits that the education recipients receive over the course of their lifetime, and that's just extremely dangerous, you know, not only for the wider implications, you know, for the U.S. education system, but also for the global economy, because if they can't pay back those debts, obviously, that leads to a greater increase in the size of this bubble that could be burst. So, you know, the U.S. is finding itself again in a situation where it could be the cause of the crisis. Again, focus then is redirected back on China to lead the way out.
Steve King, go ahead.
What this is actually showing is that the people in charge of the capitalist economy don't understand how capitalism works. This is the real problem, because we remember that none of the official bodies except the Bank of International Settlements had any warning, any idea the crisis is going to hit in 2008. The Federal Reserve itself was believing as of December of 2007 that there was going to be no recession. That was after the recession was officially started, when the statistics were finally assembled. So they have been clueless, and they remain clueless after the crisis. They still don't know what caused it, and it was caused by a private credit bubble. That's obvious when you look at the data, but they ignore that data because conventional economic theory tells them not to worry about the banking sector, not to worry about finance and making their macroeconomic models. So what we have is basically a bunch of clueless chooks in suits trying to run a global economy they don't understand. And I think this is, in that sense, is one reason why the G20 meeting and even G7 don't really matter. The people who are attending those meetings don't understand the system they're trying to manage at all. It's finally become apparent now that the bubble has burst in America and Europe, when it now again bursts in China and the remaining other countries that managed to avoid the crisis by yet more borrowing, including Korea, Canada, Australia, and indeed Norway and Sweden even, when they finally end up, we really are going to see that we've got headless chooks in charge of the global economy.
Steve, I want to ask you, though, the same question that I had asked Mark. Does the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government have the same capacity in the face of another major economic contraction to do what it did in 2007, 2008? In other words, not bring everything back to where it was, but at least preserve the basic centers of economic power, the main institutions, the Wall Street banks. Does it have the ability to stimulate the economy, given the fact that we've been at almost negative interest or zero interest rates for some time, even if the Yellen and the Federal Reserve is considering now raising the interest rates slightly? What's left in the toolbox?
Well, the question of the toolbox has actually got unlimited power. There's that they simply don't know how to use it. So what they've done with quantitative easing, for example, this particularly applies in the States. They've bought bonds off the private banks in the belief that will give them extra reserves that they will then lend out to the public. That is simply not possible. It is defying the laws of accounting. You can't lend out reserves. If you lend out reserves, your assets fall, therefore your liabilities have to fall, which means you have to lend less. It's simply bad economics based on bad accounting at the same time, or ignoring accounting. So their actual idea of how to cure the problem has been completely wrong. But they have unlimited capacity to create money, and they could easily put that money into people's private bank accounts and use it to cancel debt and reduce debt that way. That's what I've been arguing myself for about 10 years now. So they have the power, they have the arsenal there. It's simply that they don't understand how a monetary capitalist economy actually functions. I know that sounds ridiculous to anybody who hasn't done an economics degree.
Is it foolishness or idiocy or failure to know, or is it driven by some other political factors, restrictions, calculations on their part? Because obviously, they're printing money. They're giving money to the biggest banks. The idea is that those banks would then lend to investors or to people who wanted to create jobs. But in fact, the lending hasn't happened.
And they cannot do it. This is the, technically, it's impossible for that money to be lent out. It's hard to explain on a radio show, but if you're going to create a loan, you simply say, we like your idea. Here's $1 million, which we put on the liability side, boosting up your deposit account, which is a bank liability. And by the way, you owe us $1 million, which is the loan we now record also as an asset on our asset side. So the assets and the reserve liabilities go up together. The idea, if you give banks reserves, which are an asset, and say, give those to the public, if they give those to the public, their reserve assets decline. It is simply bad accounting to actually believe you can even lend this money out. It's a bit like saying, if I put lubricating oil into the engine, that will therefore give me extra petrol. No, it isn't. It's a completely separate system. And it is just ignorance of the actual basic fundamentals of money that led to the type of decisions the central banks have made in the last 20 years, and also the form of the rescue that they took. Now, if they actually understand it, they can say, well, this money shouldn't go into the effectively the lubrication system of the engine, it should go into the petrol tank, then they could do it. They are not unable to do that. But if they did that, then they would have some impact. But it really, I'm watching a bunch of people running a petrol station who think by putting lubrication oil in the cars will go faster, and they're wondering why the cars aren't leaving the petrol station.
So if I'm understanding you properly, what you're saying is if the government actually used the funds that are available to a government or this government, the United States government, to help people purchase, in other words, to overcome the problem of overcapacity or overproduction by dealing with the problem of underconsumption, in other words, giving people money so that they could purchase, that would be the system that would actually be, or the tool that could possibly remedy or provide relief for an economy in the doldrums.
Yeah, that would work. I mean, that's why people are calling helicopter money after Milton Friedman's quip from about 50 years ago or 60 years ago. And that is feasible. It's not what they're doing right now. And it is, as Michael Hudson puts it, the helicopter is dropping the money over Wall Street, not over Main Street. To redirect it over Main Street, you simply have to use the government's money creating capacity to mean that rather than putting an entry in the reserve accounts of the private banks at the central bank, it puts money into the private accounts, you and your bank account and my bank account, had held at private banks. And that is quite possible for the government to do that. I would then also add the stricture that would have to be done, first of all, on a per capita, a uniform basis across the country, so it reduces inequality, but also require debtors to pay their debts down. So debtors don't get any cash. They simply get debt cancellation, whereas savers get a cash injection. And that is quite feasible, but they won't do it. For two reasons. One is because they don't understand the monetary system well enough to know that's actually would work. And two, the politics that they've managed to generate that have demonized government spending and government action like that in a capitalist country for the last 30 years has so turned the public against that being done that the public itself would resist it. So I see them being really quite caught between a rock and a hard place. And that's why, as I said about 15 years ago when I wrote the first edition of Debunking Economics, the global economy is going to turn Japanese. That's what it's done.
Mark Sloboda, let's go back to your comfort zone. Let's go back to the politics or the military and diplomatic impact of what's going on, which is intertangled very deeply with the economics of the G20. You have in the G20, and again, in this segment, we're talking about the main drivers outside of China of the G20, the EU countries and the United States. You have a number of EU countries, particularly Italy, France, Germany, that would like to, in fact, have more trade with Russia. Russia would be a natural trading partner and has been historically. At the same time, you have the U.S. government demonizing Russia and trying to maintain the old Western post-World War II alliance by creating ever more tensions and, as a matter of discipline of that alliance, requiring its so-called allies to stop doing business with Russia, a business that actually helps them and hurts them when they don't have it. How do those kind of issues, the tensions perhaps between the EU countries and the United States, play out either at the G20 or on the sidelines or in general?
Yeah, I think on top of all these structural issues and bubbles that we talk about, we have to recognize that global politics has also been putting a lot of shocks and stress on this economic system that was already, you know, having a very tepid recovery from crisis a few years ago. And we're talking about the sanctions that the West leveled on Russia after Russia was unaccepting of the, you know, the West-backed overthrow of the elected Ukrainian government, you know, to try to force them to to accept these changes, as it were, Russia fighting for some retention of their influence in the Ukraine. That has a big impact, and that is continuing to play. But also the games that have been played by Saudi Arabia with the global energy markets by overproducing on oil. Oil is a tremendous part of the global economy. It is still the driver. Energy is still largely left out of financial economic discussions. But this has had a big impact as well. To settle the Ukrainian crisis, because that, of course, will play a role at the G20. Originally, Putin was supposed to meet with two members of the Normandy format, Merkel and Holland, together without Ukraine at the table because of a recent Ukrainian saboteur terrorist incursion into now Russian Crimea. That Putin is refusing to even talk with the leader of the Ukrainian regime, Poroshenko. But this has been now stepped down, where Putin is only meeting bilaterally with Merkel and with Holland, rather than all three of them together. And I think this is probably due to some U.S. and Kiev regime pressure. Likewise, the Russian government made some very strong noises that they wanted Putin to meet with Obama on the sidelines of the summit.
Okay, we have about 90 seconds left. Steve Keen, I want to go back to you. Of course, even though politics, diplomacy, military issues are always on the table, even if they're not explicitly or formally on the table at a G20. The bottom line for this summit has been economy, been economics, has been the state of the world economy. The IMF issued a call earlier this year for countries to spend more to improve the global economy. I just want to leave it there with you on that. The Germans shut down with the finance minister saying, debt finance growth model has reached its limits. In other words, rejecting the IMF's sort of dictates. What do you think?
Yeah, the only way out of this crisis is to reduce the levels of private debt. That's what caused the crisis in the first place. And so long as they continue focusing on government debt, which is what all the finance ministers are obsessed about, they won't even get to the problem itself. This is where Japan has been now for 25 years. And it's obvious that we're going to, with the level of understanding that we have at the top level, I mean virtually none, and the level of understanding amongst the economic profession is probably even worse than none, we're not going to address this crisis in any sensible way, is going to come instead through populist politics, as we've seen in the American electoral system, as we've seen in England and in Europe. And that is going to give us turmoil rather than leadership from the top.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We will be back tomorrow. We've been talking to Steve Keen and Mark Sloboda. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.